The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. House Democrats get lectured by legal scholar Jonathan Turley during Chairman Nadler's impeachment proceeding.
My personal views are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote.
And as the Senate preps for trial, Senator Tom Cotton laments the lack of progress on Capitol Hill.
We haven't passed the budget. There's a lot of work that is not getting done.
Two bills have been introduced to challenge China's oppression, hopefully serving as a prod towards liberty to Beijing. Admiral James Stavridis comments.
We are going to have to confront China on a variety of issues.
And a grim update on the worsening circumstances in Iran from Elon Berman.
There was a sense among Iranians, ordinary Iranians, that their lives would get better.
Right.
Their lives haven't gotten better.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. Following what seemed to be endless days, even weeks of impeachment hearings in Chairman Schiff's closed House Intelligence Committee, the hearings have now moved circus-like to their most appropriate venue, if there is one, the House Judiciary Committee, and the ringmaster is Chairman Jerry Nadler. The objective, of course, is producing an article or articles ready for a full House vote. One of the first to testify was George Washington University's law professor Jonathan Turley, an expert in constitutional law, called before the committee at the request of President Trump. Ironically, Turley had testified in support of the President Clinton impeachment 21 years ago, but he did not do so this past Wednesday. The difference? Clinton had committed a crime. Trump has not been so charged. It's very unlikely he will be. There just isn't any evidence of a crime. Turley began his comments pointedly, reminding the chairman where they had met once before.
21 years ago, I sat before you, Chairman Nadler, and this committee to testify at the impeachment of President William Jefferson Clinton. I never thought that I would have to appear a second time to address the same question with regard to another sitting president. Yet here we are. The elements are strikingly similar. The intense rancor and rage of the public debate is the same. It's the atmosphere that the framers anticipated. The stifling intolerance of opposing views is the same. I'd like to start, therefore, perhaps incongruously, by stating an irrelevant fact. I'm not a supporter of President Trump. I voted against him. My personal views of President Trump are as irrelevant to my impeachment testimony as they should be to your impeachment vote. President Trump will not be our last president. And what we leave in the wake of this scandal will shape our democracy for generations to come.
Should the House pass impeachment articles against Mr. Trump, the Senate will be the next stop, where there is likely to be a full impeachment trial with Chief Justice John Roberts presiding. I turn to Arkansas Senator Tom Cotton, a frequent guest on my program, to talk about Senate preparations for this sadly historic event. Did you ever in your imagination see yourself as a juror in an impeachment trial of a president?
No, regrettably, Hugh. It looks like I may be that. The Democrats in the House have continued with their obsession about impeachment. I gather they're probably going to pass articles of impeachment sometime this month unless they come to their senses, in which case they'll come to the Senate for a trial. I don't think anyone expects that there will be 67 votes to remove the president from office. In fact, I think there'll probably be more Democratic votes against impeachment in both the House and the Senate than there are Republican votes in favor of it. the really regrettable thing, too, is that the people's business is not being done. In the meantime, Hugh, we haven't passed a budget to fund our government, especially our military. We haven't passed the annual defense bill that's been passed 58 consecutive years. There's a lot of work that is not getting done while Nancy Pelosi's House is obsessed with impeaching the president, as they have been since January 20th, 2017.
What do you think is your job as an individual juror?
Hugh, we've had some preliminary discussions about the basic rules of impeachment proceedings in the Senate. You know, we have Senate impeachment rules, even though impeachments of presidents are pretty uncommon. There have been many more impeachments of lower court judges in particular, so there are a set of standing rules that kind of give some right and left boundaries. But those rules are very, very minimal, Hugh. You know, in 1998, there was a unanimous resolution to structure the Clinton impeachment trial. I'm not sure that that's going to be the case in today's Senate. But if they send articles of impeachment over here, I think we'll take a careful look at them. From what I've read in the news, some of them might deserve immediate dismissal. You know, if, for instance, they say that the president or his aides litigating their constitutional prerogatives in court is de facto evidence of obstruction of justice. But I also believe the president wants to actually put on a genuine defense of his actions. That's what I've heard from him. The Senate is a place where he can actually get a fair proceeding to present the evidence and arguments in his defense, unlike Star Chamber in the House.
Some of your colleagues, including Senator Klobuchar and Senator Warren, have already declared their belief in the president's guilt. Ought they to recuse themselves from this proceeding?
Well, Hugh, as you know, if you go read Alexander Hamilton's Federalist Papers on impeachment, it's not exactly like a criminal case. They're not looking for impartial jurors. And our founding fathers knew that when they made the Senate the trial for impeachment, that it already might have people who are partisans in one way or another for the accused individual.
Do you think that, among others, the whistleblower and Hunter Biden ought to be called, and Adam Schiff? Three questions. Whistleblower, Hunter Biden, Adam Schiff. Should they be fact witnesses?
I think there's a strong case they should be fact witnesses in the Senate, Hugh. Now, ultimately, I think that decision will be up to the president's lawyers in the impeachment trial. But whatever you think about Joe Biden and Hunter Biden, you cannot dispute that there was a gross conflict of interest. Perhaps there's nothing there, but it certainly is worth reviewing, and it certainly goes to the president's thinking whenever he's made statements that he wanted Burisma investigated.
It's going to be fascinating. How long do you think it will last, Senator Cotton?
We don't really know, Hugh. It'll be up to whatever 51 senators vote on in terms of a process, and also to what the president's lawyers want to call as witnesses.
And how are the House Republicans doing with this proceeding? As it has been from the beginning, they see right through it. My colleague Mike Gallagher, broadcasting from Jerusalem, took a look at an interview between Georgia Representative Doug Collins, the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee, sitting down with Chris Wallace of Fox News.
Doug Collins is saying, you want to go down the impeachment path? See, here's the thing about an impeachment. Both sides have to testify. Here's the thing about actually stupidly going forward trying to impeach the 45th president of the United States. The Democrats are going to have to speak under oath. And a lot of people who have been anti-Trump are going to have to be held to account. And that to me is pretty enormous. Let's listen together to cuts one and two. Here's Congressman Doug Collins. He was on with Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday. And frankly, he's very clear here. Very first witness that he wants called, Shifty Schiff himself. Here's cut one.
First and foremost, the first person needs to testify is Adam Schiff. Adam Schiff is the author of this report. Adam Schiff has been the author of many things, a lot of them found to be false over the past couple of years, but he's going to be the author of this report. He's compared himself in the past to a special counsel. This is what he said he was doing. Well, if we go back to Clinton and even back to Nixon, but in Clinton, Ken Starr was a special counsel. He presented a report that we're going to get as judiciary. He actually came and sat and testified under oath and took questions from all sides, including the White House. My first and foremost witness is Adam Schiff.
So you want to bring him in before the committee, not just to present a report, but to take questions from Democrats and to be cross-examined, if you will, by the Republicans.
He needs to be. He's put himself into that position. If he chooses not to, then I really question his veracity and what he's putting in his report. I question his, you know, the motives of why he's doing it. It's easy to hide behind a report. It's easy to hide behind a gavel in intelligence committees and behind closed-door hearings. But it's going to be one another thing to actually get up and have to answer questions about what his staff knew, how he knew.
I'm really begging for somebody listening to that exchange to explain to me why it's so difficult to understand that if the Bidens were involved with Ukrainian corruption, why should that not be on the table? And I want you to hear this. Cut number two, Chris Wallace really pressing Doug Collins about the same narrative over and over again. President Trump, you know, investigating or wanting Ukraine to investigate his political rival, Joe Biden. And this is making me crazy because it seems so obvious to me. Joe Biden was the vice president of the United States for 8 years. Joe Biden's son, Hunter, was on a board of an energy company called Burisma that is said to have been investigated for corruption. How do you give Joe Biden a pass because he may or may not be the Democrat nominee for president in 2020? I'm serious. Maybe this is one of these times when I'm really directing this question only to Trump haters. If you hate Trump, or if you're a Democrat, maybe you just don't agree with my worldview on anything. Tell me how you want to pretend that Joe Biden wasn't the vice president, and his son wasn't on the Burisma board. How is that not a legitimate, logical thing to ask? Hey, let's investigate a connection here. Once you hear cut two, though, here's again Chris Wallace pushing hard on Doug Collins, saying, what about this whole business of investigating your political rival if you're the president? Cut two from Fox News and Grabian.
Simply, do you see anything wrong with that? The president conditioning support for Ukraine, whether it was a meeting, whether with Zelensky, whether it's military, conditioning support for Ukraine to that country investigating some of the president's political rivals.
Well, I think it's interesting that the premise of your question is based on witnesses who agree with your premise. I disagree and say that Mr. Volker, Mr. Morrison, even Mr. Sondland, who presumed it was being conditioned, the president himself told Senator Johnson there was no precondition. There's nothing to be presumed on this. So if you want to show one side, then also show the other side as we go along with this. President Trump has always been concerned about foreign aid. He's always been concerned about what's going on in the Ukraine and in Europe and how is Europe participating and how our tax dollars. The question is, though, if we're looking at corruption, does it matter who's involved? That's the problem in the policy issue that got discussed in Intel. He was looking at the corruption part of this. And yes, if the Bidens were involved, then they would have been a part of that.
But this is a big week. The president is being impeached over this. We've had this happen, what, 3-4 times in our nation's history. They are absolutely trying to take this president down over this issue.
Coming up,
we are moving in a direction where we are going to have to confront China on a variety of issues. The key is we don't want to have this thing explode into not just a Cold War, Hugh, but a hot war.
The U.S. sends a signal to China on humanitarian issues. A Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Stay with us. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, the Alliance Defending Freedom. For over 6 months, demonstrations in Hong Kong have received widespread attention. Many have been asking, would President Xi move to aggressively strike down this largely youth-led resistance movement against state repression? And then on November 16th, a report in the New York Times was headlined, quote, "Absolutely no mercy. Leaked files expose how China organized mass detention of Muslims." Recently, two bills passed Congress in response. First, the Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which was signed by the president. This week, another bill threatening sanctions against China regarding its treatment of the Uyghur Muslims passed unanimously through the Congress. I spoke with an Asia expert, retired Admiral James Stavridis, who also used to helm NATO, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I have a column on China congratulating President Trump this morning in the Washington Post for bringing this attention to the forefront, this issue to the forefront. And you just got back from the region, I believe Vietnam. Where is this standoff going to head? Because I don't see clinking of glasses and a trade deal coming up time anytime soon.
I commend the administration both for the stance against the persecution, really, of these Uyghurs, as well as the support for the Hong Kong Act and the demonstrators in Hong Kong. But there will be consequences. There will be pushback from China. I think it'll come not only in the trade region, Hugh, but look for the Chinese military to become more aggressive in the South China Sea as we conduct our ongoing freedom of navigation patrols there.
Now, Admiral, you and I have talked in the past about Silicon Valley selling whatever they can sell to the Chinese. I talk about this in the Washington Post column today. They viewed it as just another market, albeit an enormous market, but it's more than just another market. And when you sell facial recognition technology to General Secretary Xi, it's going to end up putting the Uyghurs into their concentration camps. Have you seen any signs that Silicon Valley is now awake?
I am seeing those signs, Hugh, and they're manifesting in an interesting way. I'm seeing more of the tech leadership beginning to talk very coherently about the moral and principal consequences here. So you're seeing that conversation start to bubble, and these things aren't going to change overnight. And let's not forget it was U.S. policy for decades that we were going to embrace China and help the rise of the dragon peacefully and all of that. But that conversation is turning. And then secondly, I'm seeing more of the tech world, in particular on the artificial intelligence and the cybersecurity side, predisposed to cooperate with the U.S. government on our efforts there. So, yes, there's progress, but let's face it, that's going to be an important front in the confrontation between the United States and China.
Am I right about the comprehensive nature of the competition?
Spot on. And at recent conference in Asia, Henry Kissinger said we are in the foothills of a Cold War. I would put it probably slightly differently. I would say we're in a series of skirmishes in all of the areas you've talked about, from trade to military action to the South China Sea to moral and ethical and legal policy choices. We're in skirmishes in all those areas. Sometimes skirmishes do lead to wars. It'll be, I think, a cold war. I'm not predicting a hot war with China. But we are moving in a direction where we are going to have to confront China on a variety of issues. And I think the administration's been roughly right here, trying to bend China, particularly on trade and tariffs. The key is we don't want to have this thing explode into not just a Cold War, Hugh, but a hot war. Not impossible. So we've got to work across all of the vectors you described in order to create a strategy to deal with China.
Instability in the Middle East is heightened once again. The problem stems from citizen unrest, with demonstrations reported in Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, and worst of all, Iran, where hundreds have been killed. My Salem colleague Sebastian Gorka spoke with Elon Berman, Senior Vice President of the American Foreign Policy Council, whose focus is on regional security in the Middle East.
There's the real world, and then there's the media. Because in any other time, I think, the fact that hundreds of protesters in the country that is the largest sponsor of state terrorism have been killed by the authorities would be on the front pages of every newspaper for days. But it's not, Ilhan Berman. This is unbelievable. We'll talk about why that is in a second. But can you give us an update? You follow these things. What's going on in Iran?
Sure. And by the way, to preface this, it's not just Iran. It's right. happening in Iraq. It's happening in Lebanon. And it's all part of a larger puzzle.
Right.
Since 2015, since the JCPOA, the nuclear deal that President Obama signed and walked us into, the Iranian regime has been on a path of sustained expansion. They've been expanding around the region.
And this is this isn't your trade expansion. This is
no,
military. This is proxies
and
terrorism
and trade and politics, right, and influence. All of it enabled by the enormous economic and strategic benefits that they got as a result of the Obama's deal. And what you're seeing now is that there is overstretch on the part of this incipient Iranian empire. There are protests going on in Iraq. There are protests going on in Lebanon. And they're about a lot of things. They're about government mismanagement, corruption. But they're also about Iranian interference. And there are even protests taking place right now within Iran itself against the regime.
But let's be clear here. There's multiple constituencies.
Right.
So there are those who are in other countries who are fed up of Iran's intervention. But perhaps most important of all, Ilan, are the Iranians who are saying, we can't afford to feed our kids, and you're fighting wars in Yemen, right? So it's protesting their own regime.
That's exactly right. And so there was a sense among Iranians, ordinary Iranians, that this deal that the Islamic Republic hammered out with the United States would have some sort of trickle-down effect, that their lives would get better.
Right.
Their lives haven't gotten better. The Iranian Ayatollahs spend much more money on guns than they do on butter. And the Iranians are fed up. And in real economic terms, ordinary Iranians are a third poorer than they were in 1979. So think about that for a second. Think about
a third poorer.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. In real terms.
After $140 billion was released to them by the last administration.
That's right. That's right. And not only
and one of the richest oil nations in the world.
Correct. And richest natural gas nations in the world. And a country that has spent the last half decade capitalizing on this diplomatic deal by normalizing trade with Europe, with the West. In a pretty dramatic fashion. And yet none of that is really translating into prosperity at home. So Iranians are young, overwhelmingly. Two-thirds of a country of 84 million are younger than the regime, meaning they weren't around when the Ayatollah...
So they're born after 79.
No, correct. When they weren't around when Ruhollah Khomeini stepped off the plane in Tehran. They don't buy into the core tenets of the Islamic Republic. They are really just interested in what the regime can do for them. The regime's not doing much for them. It's doing a lot of expansionism in the region, but there's not prosperity at home. And so you're seeing this grassroots pushback, and it's really dramatic, and it's really potentially transformative, which is why the regime is cracking down. Their regime's response to the current protests has actually been much more draconian than what you've seen in the past, because the Ayatollahs are scared.
As you know, my family history, so as a child of those who escaped a dictatorship, literally, my father escaped a communist prison, was liberated. I have a certain baggage I bring or perspective. At the end of the day, what Stalin said, how many tank divisions does the Pope have, kind of comes to the fore. As long as the regime has all the tanks and the guns, are they going to stay in control? Or are you seeing fissures inside the regime where somebody could perhaps defect?
Well, that's the real question. And the answer is we don't know.
For the complete interview with Admiral Stavridis, with Sebastian's, with Ilan Berman, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
When does 16 mean 8? When you're sentenced to 16 years in prison in Britain.
Misplaced compassion turns lethal. The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Terror incidents struck recently in Britain and in Europe. In London, it was a stabbing attack that killed two and injured three others, culminating in the London Bridge with the intervention of heroic bystanders. It was not far from the scene of another Islamist attack in 2017 that left 8 dead. Here's my friend and colleague, Dennis Prager.
The story is very important because of the nature of the murderer and how it was possible that he was allowed to murder. The British authorities allowed him to murder. They released him from prison, even though he was a terrorist. So let me read to you from Theodore Dalrymple. In 2012, Khan, that is the guy, Usman Khan, he attended a conference at Fishmongers Hall, a grand location in central London. And I'll tell you about 2012 in a moment. Marking the fifth anniversary of a rehabilitative program for prisoners called Learning Together, run by Cambridge University's Institute of Criminology. Suddenly, Khan, wielding a knife and wearing an imitation suicide bomber's vest, went on a rampage, killing a graduate of the institute who helped run the conference and a volunteer worker at the event. also a Cambridge graduate, as well as injuring three people. In 2012, now this is the key here. In 2012, Khan, along with eight others, was convicted for plotting to blow up the London Stock Exchange, kill Boris Johnson, the then mayor of London, and plant bombs in synagogues, among other places. He had also planned to set up a military training camp for terrorists on his ancestral lands in Kashmir in Pakistan. Okay, this is the guy. Why was he out of prison? Initially, Khan was given an indeterminate sentence, a form of punishment introduced by Tony Blair's government, which meant that he could be released only if the parole board thought he was no longer a threat to the public. This type of sentence was struck down on appeal, not on the correct grounds that it violated the rule of law, amounting to arbitrary preventive detention, but because it was feared that it would lead to the prisoner being detained longer than necessary. You got that? Hear that thinking? Okay. A judge replaced Khan's indeterminate sentence with a 16-year prison term, though in practice this meant only 8 years in prison, since the Blair government had passed a law mandating the release of prisoners after they had served only half their terms. 16 means nothing. It means eight. That's like a riddle. When, that's like kids, you know, they do that. All right, Uncle Dennis, when does 16 mean eight? When you're sentenced to 16 years in prison in Britain. Correct. Khan was released from prison in 2018, but without any input from the parole board. The public discussion in the wake of Khan's terrorist attack reveals three superstitions. That's great. This is my man Dalrymple. That thanks to the activities of criminologists, sociologists, psychologists, and others, all disciplines poisoned by the left, meaning that they don't think clearly and their moral compass is broken, definitionally, are now deeply ingrained in the public mind. The first superstition is that terrorists are ill and are both in need of and susceptible to rehabilitation, as if there existed some kind of moral physiotherapy that would strengthen the moral fiber, or a psychological vaccine that would immunize them against terrorist inclinations. The second superstition is that once terrorists have undergone these technical processes or treatments, it can be known for certain that the treatments have worked and that some means exist to assess whether the terrorists still harbor violent desires and intentions. The third superstition is that there exists a way of monitoring terrorists after their release that will prevent them from carrying out attacks should they somehow slip through the net. So this guy stabs two people to death last week in London. He had gotten out. He had already plotted to blow up places in London. Got out in 8 years. He's going to form a horrible terrorist. And his views did not change. They just let him out because they're progressive. Progressives don't fight evil. They fight good guys.
Coming up.
Some have suggested that Lisa Page is speaking out now. Perhaps in anticipation of the forthcoming Horowitz report. It's officially been 18 months since she left the government.
James Rosen, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Recently, Senate Judiciary Chairman Lindsey Graham announced that the much-anticipated report from the Inspector General of the Department of Justice is due December 9. That report will come from Michael Horowitz from within the Department of Justice. It is expected to shed light on events leading up to the Russia collusion investigation. It is widely anticipated that some key individuals will be named and discussed in the report, including James Comey, Andrew McCabe, and Lisa Page. Having heard that Lisa Page spoke to a Daily Beast reporter last week, my colleague Sebastian Gorka became curious. He turned to James Rosen, the longtime contributor at Fox News, now doing investigative reporting for Sinclair Broadcasting.
This breaking news. Lisa Page, if you were caught up in the maelstrom that is the crossfire hurricane counterintelligence investigation operation against candidate Trump and then President Trump, and then your texting on your government phone, let's say just indiscreet things to the FBI agent you're having an affair with as a married woman. Do you think, at least, would you have given this interview that Lisa Page has just given to the Daily Beast?
If I were advising Lisa Page, I would have said, don't give any interviews. Instead, save it for your book eventually, right? That would be the best
advice. Or the grand jury subpoena.
Well, so far, there's no indication that Lisa Page is in legal jeopardy. Let's begin at the beginning, Seb. For the benefit of our listeners, who is Lisa Page?
Yes.
Lisa Page was a former senior attorney at the FBI. She was there, not only there, but occupying that position and playing a key role in both the Hillary Clinton private email server investigation and the Trump-Russia crossfire hurricane investigation that you just referenced.
Yes.
And it has since been disclosed that she was having a relationship with her colleague, the deputy assistant director of the FBI, Peter Strzok, who also was playing a central role in the Hillary Clinton case and the Trump-Russia case. And their text messages were eventually made public. And in those text messages in August of 2016, Lisa Page wrote at one point, he's not going to become president, about Mr. Trump. Right? Right? Question mark? Exclamation mark? With a hint of panic in her texting voice. And her colleague Strzok wrote back, no, he's not. I won't let it. We won't let it happen, in essence. He also wrote about a meeting that they had had in Andy's office a week later. That was Andy McCabe, the former deputy director of the FBI, who's also left the agency disgraced, as Page and Strzok have. And he spoke about an insurance plan in the event that Mr. Trump did win. These texts have figured very prominently in the view that Republicans have of all that went down in 2016. And in particularly, President Trump has spoken about Lisa Page and Peter Strzok and what those texts mean. And he calls it nothing less than an attempted coup. We're soon to get a report next week, just about a week from today, from Michael Horowitz. He is the inspector general.
December 9th.
At the Department of Justice. And he has already written and published many reports critical of people like James Comey and Andy McCabe and Strzok and Page. But his report is going to examine the origins of the Trump-Russia probe and whether, in particular, the FISA surveillance that was secured against Carter Page, a former Trump campaign advisor, was legal and constitutionally valid. So some have suggested that Lisa Page is speaking out now. I think you have among those who suggested that she's speaking out now. She gave her first interview ever to the Daily Beast. It was published today. Perhaps in anticipation of the forthcoming Horowitz report. The article in the Daily Beast states that she's speaking out now because it's officially been 18 months since she left the government.
So you've covered the Watergate scandal. You've written
as a historian.
As a historian.
So we're clear, not as a Daily Deadline reporter in 1973.
School us a little bit. I find it so strange. Maybe it's growing up in the UK where we have very strong sub judice rules. You don't talk about anything that's potentially a matter of judicial process. In the Watergate years, did people who were named individuals in certain scandals, did they? This woman's giving an interview to Daily Beast, but we have others. We have Comey and others that are going on book tours. Did that happen in the past with people who were in the spotlight for the wrong reasons, James Rosen?
Watergate is really the birth of that. Watergate is where you see for the first time this conflation of public events, current events, shall we say, scandal, and a large commercial industry arising to exploit it and leverage it. You know, the Watergate memoir was the beginning of what we've seen now, and now people don't even wait until things have played out.
No.
They're publishing them in real time. People, in fact, forget that All the President's Men was published while President Nixon was still president. So, yes, it happened in the past. John Dean, as I believe around the time he was testifying to the Senate, the Senate Watergate Committee, which was a big deal, televised, et cetera,
yes,
gave an interview first to Walter Cronkite, of CBS News at the time. So This is why I call Watergate the birth of the modern. Everything you're seeing now, special counsels, litigation over documents, impeachment, all of this, really, in the modern era, the Nixon presidency, that's why I find it so fascinating, is kind of the template for all of these things.
But there's more meat on this bone, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think a supporter of President Trump would say, no, in fact, there's no more meat on this bone than was present in Watergate. They would say that this is a sham.
I'm talking about the other way around. I'm talking about what the DOJ is investigating now.
So the implications for what happened in 2016 really are large and important. It's not been established that a crime has been committed. I think that it may also just be the case that we're in such a much more polarized climate now than we were in the Watergate era, that even on the basis of what's come before us so far, most so-called average Americans have already made up their mind about this event. And I think that a number of the procedural oddities associated with this impeachment proceeding, the fact that it's...
Mildly put, very, very selective word usage there, James.
The fact that it took place originally in the Intelligence Committee.
Yes.
The fact that, there are other aspects to it.
Other transcripts not released.
Fact that really what you're stuffing the elephant of impeachment through the mouse hole of the whistleblower process, okay,
in a sense. Interesting. Good way of putting it, yes.
Despite all this, I think that it may be the case that the Democrats recognize that it's not a winning issue for them, not in the way that potentially they think health care can be.
Right.
Or certain other aspects of the Trump presidency.
But it's dominating their actions.
For the moment. But the very haste that we see associated with the process suggests to me that the Democrats themselves, at least the leadership, understand that they want to get this over
because
with
it's happening
quickly.
Surprisingly fast, isn't it?
It is. It's much faster than any previous impeachment cycle. Right. Yes, this is moving very fast, and I think not just because the Democrats correctly see that moving swiftly provides them with a tactical advantage over the White House, but also because they might not see this as the best issue for them as they head into 2020.
To hear the complete conversation with James Rosen, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up.
Everywhere, students are taught to think of themselves as oppressed.
Student meltdown at Holy Cross. Stick around for the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it, you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day. This week, the church grapples with the roles of men and women.
The Bible does not take sides between man and woman. The Bible takes sides against the people who would take sides between man and woman.
A Christian school loses voucher funding due to their biblically based beliefs.
There is no place for government discrimination, specifically hostility towards religion, in American public life.
And Nikki Haley, our former ambassador to the United Nations, talks about her working relationship with President Donald Trump.
He was true to his word from his first day to his last day. And so he really let me do my job. And I have always been very grateful for that.
To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Heather McDonald, contributing editor of the City Journal and author of The Diversity Delusion, is back in the news. In fact, she's often in the news because she dares to speak and write about the truth, often as a guest speaker on college campuses. My Salem colleague Larry Elder recently caught up with Ms. McDonald following a noteworthy experience at the College of the Holy Cross in Worcester, Massachusetts.
My goodness, also you got the same kind of treatment at Bucknell.
Well, I pretty much get it wherever I go because the ideology of victimhood, the maudlin self-pity that I witnessed and wrote about recently at Holy Cross and Bucknell are really everywhere. Nobody should try and, you know, make themselves feel better that this is just a few elite schools. Everywhere, students are taught to think of themselves as oppressed.
Now, Heather, your topic was Renaissance humanism. At Holy Cross, anyway. So, what does it have to do with Heather Mack has got to go. Hey, my oppression is not delusional. You came to talk about Renaissance humanism.
Among other things, I was holding out the Renaissance humanists as a model for us all. They were absolutely passionate about the discovery of classical learning that had been lost for centuries. They fanned out across Europe, went to monasteries trying to find these lost manuscripts by Cicero and Livy and the greats of Roman literature. And they had what Ralph Waldo Emerson calls a canine appetite for knowledge. So I was discussing this fabulous comic novel by a 16th century French author, François Rabelais, called Gargantua. And at that point, over half of the students in the packed auditorium at Holy Cross College in Worcester, Mass., stood up and gave the chant that you opened with, Larry, that my oppression is not a delusion, my oppression is not a delusion. And then they changed the template to, your racism is not welcome, your sexism is not welcome, your homophobia is not welcome, you are not welcome, which was sort of obvious by then. But, you know, this has been planned. Holy Cross would probably say in its defense, well, eventually, after these students left the place, the students who had managed to get in were allowed to speak. The real people who deserve an apology here is the students who had wanted to engage with me. I always try to be even-handed, Larry, and think, am I engaged in the same kind of blindness as the left is towards me? And, you know, a lot of times conservatives are unaware of their own double standards. But I do have to say, I don't think there's anything quite the same on the right for the really reductive name-calling that goes on the left. You know, racist, sexist, homophobe, white privilege, you name it. There's just a complete unwillingness to engage with facts that challenge the orthodoxies.
For the rest of the conversation with Heather McDonald, go to townhallreview.com. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richard, David Posian, Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.